When sound recording first emerged, critics claimed it could be the end of music. The American composer John Philip Sousa bemoaned the harm records brought to his art, reducing the expression of music to a mathematical system of megaphones, wheels, cogs, discs, and cylinders. But a century or so on, and this same technology has advanced to take music into new, unimaginable realms. I'm Nick Mason. I play drums in Pink Floyd, and you're listening to A History of Music and Technology on the BBC World Service. In this week's programme, we begin the story of the recording studio, exploring how it has evolved from being a simple conduit for capturing sound to become an instrument in its own right, a collaborator which kick-started a creative shift for musicians since they first stepped up to the mic.
This was a really alien type of performance for musicians in those days, because most of the time people would be on a stage and there would be an audience, but in a recording studio they would come into a room that was generally empty. And this took quite a bit of adjustment. So these were well-established musicians who would play in front of large audiences, who then clammed up and became quite anxious when staring at a microphone. There were people who described having what they called gramophone fright.
Professor Mark Katz from the University of North Carolina.
There was a great deal of anxiety on the part of many recording artists that when they recorded, it was permanent. So anything that they did, any mistake they made, would be enshrined in wax or vinyl or shellac forever. And that did drive some people out of the business because they couldn't handle that. And French soprano Régine Crespin said, you know, how can you fall in love with a microphone? You engage with audiences and you have this intimate relationship with audiences. And the microphone is this cold piece of metal that records every mistake you make.
In the early days of recording, which began in the back half of the 19th century, studios captured sound through an acoustic recording horn. With a wide opening at one end, singers and musicians had to get up close in order to send sound waves through the recording device to be scratched onto a cylinder or disc. Professor Simon Zagorski-Thomas from the London College of Music.
The horn itself was huge in comparison to a modern microphone. The opening of the horn was bigger than a person's head, and the musicians would all be huddled around the horn because it was a very insensitive instrument in a lot of ways. You had to be right next to it and almost shrieking in order to come out. So early recordings have very little performance subtlety in them. You've got singers belting songs out, got pianists behind them thrashing away at the piano to be as loud as possible.
In what's known as the acoustic era, studios were not equipped with any kind of mixing capability. So if you wanted to adjust the levels of a singer during a recording, you couldn't just turn a knob or slide a fader. Instead, you had to move the musicians themselves. Mark Katz.
There were techniques when the music got quieter, you had to lean into the horn, and when it was louder, you had to lean back. And in fact, I've read accounts of early recording studios where they had someone called a pusher, someone that would push and pull a musician, basically stand behind the person, perhaps with their hands on them around their waist, and push them towards the horn if they were too quiet and pull them back if they got too loud. And I read one account that opera singer described this person as her dancing partner.
Simon Zagorski-Thomas.
There are photographs of cello sections sitting on chairs with wheels on and somebody behind them kind of ready to push them forward to the horn when their section came in. So you can imagine this mechanical mixing process.
This complex studio choreography was made all the more complicated by the fact that in these early years there was also no ability to edit a performance either. Sound recordings were written straight onto a phonograph cylinder or gramophone record, and so songs had to be laid down in a single take.
It might be the 20th take, but it was a single take that you were hearing. So you can never hear multiple takes put together. So it was very trying and very stressful. There are some great stories from the early days of recording where a musician would get through a take and be really happy with it and then let out a little cry of delight and it ruined the whole take, or knocked something over or coughed or anything. So there are lots of accounts from musicians in those days who say that they would much rather be on a stage and perform for 1,000 people than be in a recording studio and play for a single horn.
With the advent of sound recording, scores of independent studios cropped up both in the USA and across Europe to cash in on this new cultural craze. And all manner of spaces were used to make recordings, be it a hotel room or a theatre. But as the nascent music industry began to mature in the early years of the 20th century, the studio system started to become more corporate.
As the record companies started to develop commercially and the idea of recorded music took off properly, then the companies started to build their own facilities or to convert spaces that they owned into their own facilities. And initially they were just relatively small spaces, dark curtains covering the space. There would be a curtain or sometimes a wall between a recording machine and the horn that was used to record the musicians.
And at this time, the record labels behind these early recordings had a singular aesthetic goal, to be as realistic as possible. Professor Albin Zak is a musicologist from the State University of New York at Albany.
Always in the history of the world, you never could hear music unless you were there when it happened. But now, you could capture it, and then you could send it places, and you could go sell it places, and you could collect it and archive it. But as far as affecting the music itself, what we want to do is, as closely as possible, as faithfully as possible, capture an image of the sound of the performance as it was in the natural world, not to interfere with the music.
But from day one, music was affected by the recording process, in part due to the technological limitations of the time. This affected decisions made about the type of music recorded and the type of artists signed by the record companies.
You really needed a strong lead sound. An opera singer was particularly good, so you get people like Enrico Caruso and Dame Nellie Melba. But there was the kind of opposite problem as well, in that drum kits were too loud to record. So when you get the first jazz recordings in America in 1917-18, they're not using a drum kit. And that's not because the bands didn't play with a drum kit normally. They just couldn't record them because they would make the needle jump out of the wax when they were actually registering the sound. So you get jazz bands playing things like wooden blocks instead of a normal drum kit.
Mark Katz.
Sometimes instead of a bass, you might have a tuba. So this technology didn't just require musicians to alter their practices. It actually opened up opportunities to create music in new ways. The way I think about our interactions with technology in general is that we respond to them either by compensating for deficiencies or exploiting their possibilities. So in these early days, people did both.
And there's one invention in particular which the music industry successfully repurposed with game-changing results. While initially not intended for the recording studio, the microphone would go on to revolutionize music.
Well, the microphone was invented before it was used in recording. It was invented for the telephone, and it was also used in radio at the beginning of the 1920s when the big explosion of radio stations started to happen in America. It was only in 1925 when Western Electric developed the recording system that allowed the electrical system of the microphone to be recorded onto disc that microphones were used for recording.
The microphone ushered in the age of electrical recording, where sound levels could be boosted for the first time via vacuum tube amplifiers. And you can hear more about those in our earlier program about sound recording.
The mechanical system, which was the first way of recording things, was a direct mechanical process. So you sang into a horn that caused a little very light membrane to vibrate. You know, if you shout at a piece of paper, it moves slightly. That allowed a little needle to make holes in a wax cylinder or a disc. And that direct process was the way that things were recorded. The electrical system that was introduced in 1925 converted the vibration into a changing voltage through a microphone, and that could then be amplified, and that made the system much, much more sensitive. And so suddenly you could record a wider dynamic range, more loud and soft, and you could record a wider frequency range, how high or low in pitch something could be, because the little membranes in the microphones were much more sensitive than the large membranes in the acoustic recording horns.
Despite the obvious advances in sound quality, the major record labels were not convinced that they had to switch their studios over to the new microphone sound, which had been popularised by the rise of radio. Alison McCracken is a professor in American Studies at DePaul University in Chicago.
All the companies, and the companies are Victor and Brunswick and Edison and Columbia, all their executives are shown this new technology and they listen to this new sound. And their response is basically, well, no, the society won't accept this. People are not going to buy this because it sounds different than what they're used to. So they kind of initially rejected it. And then they did tests with focus groups. They had people listen to it, and people said, well, we like this a lot more. We actually really like the sound. And so basically, the big companies caved. All of them switched to electrical recording. Everyone did it except Edison. As a result, he actually went out of business in terms of recording fairly quickly.
And Thomas Edison, the inventor of the phonograph, wasn't the only one. This microphone technology didn't come cheap, and as a result, a lot of the smaller independent recording studios were unable to afford the switch, and they went out of business too. This in turn helped the major record labels consolidate their hold on who ran the studios and who could cash in on the new artistic opportunities offered by the mic.
If you think about the 1920s, jazz music is what you kind of think of. All the jazz bands really were helped by the fact that you could have multiple microphones in the room and you could really reproduce the nightclub sound, and they could have more individual instrumentalists also, you know, be able to be heard. Have the riffs that people are able to do in jazz, right? So you would be able to promote certain kinds of your instrumentalists during the particular recording session. So that was important.
But it wasn't just jazz bands that benefited from the invention of the microphone. Albin Zak.
Probably the most obvious thing that people noticed right away was the effect for vocalists, because there were already people who would do this sort of emulation of intimacy in their popular music vocal performances, and they would often use a horn, except instead of recording into the big side of it, they would sing through the small side of it. So that when it came out the big side, their voice was amplified, and they could do a kind of a whispery sort of intimate-seeming performance, and it could still be heard. Well, the microphone, of course, made this completely possible, and you could just put out a very, very small sound, and the microphone could amplify it to whatever level it needed to be.
The microphone introduced an immediate cultural shift, as bold and brash singers from the stage, more suited to the acoustic era, were overtaken by more sensitive singing stars.
I'd rather nighttime, there's no rest for me.
We really see everything change in 1925. It's really fast. You have this complete changeover in performers. You have, for example, Billy Murray and Ada Jones, these vaudeville tenors who were very assertive and strong and powerful, and their careers just ended.
This softer singing style came to be known as crooning, and crooners were among the first new stars to emerge as a direct result of electrical recording.
Art Gillum was a very famous radio personality. These radio performers actually were brought into recording studios because they knew how to do this kind of music.
My heart's filled with pain. Why, don't let me hope in vain. I'm blue.
Because they were already doing that kind of vocal production in radio. So he came out of Atlanta, the big Atlanta stations, and he was known as the whispering pianist. So this idea that you could have these whispering low voices in electrical recording made them a novelty. At the beginning, they were sort of promoted as a novelty. But again, this idea that it's defined as a whisper, right? It's defined as something that only electrical recording can do. Certain instruments came into being as a result of electrical recording, so strings worked much better, strings and piano sounds.
Shades of night are creeping.
So again, that lighter touch could actually be reproduced very well. So we see people starting to use guitars and ukuleles. So Nick Lucas, the guitarist and singer, he was very big, and he was promoted as the crooning troubadour. Very, very popular, and by 1929 he had the most popular song in the country, which people still associate with him, Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which Tiny Tim did later.
Tiptoe to the window, by the window, that is where I'll be. Come tiptoe through the tulips with me.
While listeners embraced these clearer and more full-bodied vocal recordings, the microphone's influence in the studio was much broader, because it was now possible to give every member of a band their own microphone, instead of everyone crowding around a single recording horn. And so the people making the recording had more control over each instrument's volume, and that presented a whole new decision-making process.
The acoustic method sort of retains a direct connection to the tangible sound. With electricity, we completely deconstruct the sound. We take the sound waves and turn them into electric impulses, electric current, and then it's not sound anymore. And so someone has to now put it back together and make it sound again. So you would in effect become a collaborative artist, which is the engineer, who's in charge of balancing the ensemble with the amplifiers that the microphones are connected to. And it changed the possibilities of everything, really. You know, Stokowski, for example, noticed right from the beginning in the 1920s when he saw an engineer mixing. He was, you know, the conductor of a large orchestra. And he said, wait a second, I'm not the conductor. That guy is. He's doing all the balancing over there. So it really starts to fundamentally change the relationships within the studio and how the final product comes about.
In addition to this, the microphone's enhanced sensitivity compared to the acoustic recording horn meant it was possible to capture a sense of the space and location in which a recording was made, such as the way a voice might reverberate around a room. This was put to use early on by John and Alan Lomax, who, beginning in the 1930s, would spend years traveling the USA recording a vast array of musicians. Greg Milner is author of Perfecting Sound Forever, An Oral History of Recorded Music.
John and Alan Lomax were a father and son duo who were both interested in the idea of making field recordings. John got grants, I think, from the Smithsonian, I believe, to go around the American South, you know, in this really barely portable machine that they'd have to drag around with them, literally show up at people's homes. Just kind of go on hints. You know, they would hear that there was certain musicians in this town that could do this and that had recorded this version of this particular field holler. So maybe they should go there and check it out. And they just kind of, you know, went where they thought they could get the best stuff. It was field songs, field hollers, work songs, folk songs, really put forth the idea of recordings as something that could preserve all kinds of musical cultures for, you know, for posterity.
But even with this academic approach to recording, John and Alan Lomax were not immune to the mediation of the microphone and the potential it had to enhance the reality they wanted to capture.
The way he saw it, he was preserving a sort of ethnomusicological purity. But by the same token, he was not above cutting aesthetic corners in a way to make things more authentic sounding. He would record convicts, for example, in acoustic spaces in prison so that they sounded better than they would if they were outdoors. So he'd have them singing their work songs as though they were outdoors, but doing it like inside the prison.
she do
me, oh, she do me.
They were recording these people that had never really been heard outside their own communities. Really all kinds of music, but in terms of what I think went on to have the biggest effect, it was these early blues musicians. They were recording Lead Belly, they recorded Muddy Waters, and there was always a push and pull between them because Lead Belly is a sort of special case because Lead Belly, although he was marketed as a blues musician, he could pretty much play anything, and there was some conflict, you know, with him and the Lomaxes in terms of what he wanted to record for them and what they wanted him. You know, they wanted him to do just traditional stuff, music of the South, whereas as Lead Belly saw it, he was an all-around consummate entertainer, and it had this really sort of Catholic with a small C musical taste, and wanted to record everything.
I went to the devil.
The evolution of recording in the early decades of the last century saw a shift in aesthetics, from the desire to capture a transparent sonic perfection to a realization that music was ripe for manipulation through recording. Though while Thomas Edison portrayed the phonograph as a mere observer of audible events, it was perhaps always the case that the studio captured a distorted reality.
The goal of recordings, and this has been true for much of the history of recording, was sonic perfection. And even from the very earliest recordings in the 1890s, the record companies talked about the perfect mirror of reality, capturing the music as it's heard, you know, in a live performance. And that, if you think about it, is really an imaginary goal, because the metaphor of the sonic mirror is really just a sonic version of what a mirror does, which is to simply reflect back what is put in front of it. But if you think about mirrors, you realize that they don't just capture reality, they also affect reality. So if you look in a mirror, you might fix your hair, you might change your outfit because of what you see in the mirror. And it's the same thing in terms of recording. It doesn't simply capture what is there, the reality also affects it.
Coming up, how American servicemen returning from the Second World War played a key role in the birth of rock and roll, and how an electric guitar legend pioneered advances in studio production. That's in A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason, after the news. I'm Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. Welcome back to A History of Music and Technology on the BBC World Service. This week, I'm telling the story of the recording studio. While the earliest studios were limited to doing little more than simply capturing sound, the introduction of the electric microphone in the 1920s opened new musical vistas, forging new genres in pop music. But it was during World War II that the Germans were developing technology which would revolutionize recorded music. And an American soldier named Jack Mullen, who was stationed in London, began to wonder what they were up to.
We used to listen to the radio, listen to the BBC, and each night the BBC went off around midnight, but we were working on into the morning.
This is Jack Mullen speaking at the Audio Engineering Society convention in 1988.
We'd tune around and find broadcasts from Germany and hear these orchestras going so beautifully, you know, and they would segue from one number to another, so you knew it was continuous music, it wasn't just records. And anyhow, I thought I was pretty familiar with what all types of recording were, and this sounded superb, and we thought probably Hitler must be having people work all night.
In fact, what Jack was listening to was magnetic tape, a recording medium so clear it sounded almost lifelike, especially compared to the scratchy records people were used to. When the war was over, Jack was sent to Germany with the Signal Corps with the instruction to hunt down this new tape technology. And it was in the small town of Bad Nauheim, just outside of Frankfurt, that he found his prize.
The Radio Frankfurt operation had moved out to this town because of the bombings in Frankfurt. And so this is where their studios were. They'd taken over a big old house, but they'd moved all the apparatus out there, and they used the living room as a studio. So it was a pretty rugged operation. I went in and saw the officer, and I asked him if he had these tape machines that they used on the air, and he said, oh, yes. And I said, could I hear one of them? And he said, okay. So he took me in and sat me down in a room, and he went off and put on a roll of tape on this machine in the back room, and all I heard was a loudspeaker in front of me. And I couldn't believe it. I'd never heard anything like that in my life before. This was the great revolution as far as I was concerned.
Jack Mullen returned to the USA with the machines he had liberated from Germany, and after developing the technology further, saw an opportunity to sell it to the entertainment industry. And it caught the ear of one of the world's biggest stars, Bing Crosby. Crosby had emerged as a crooning sensation in the 1920s and went on to become a huge star of film and radio. Musicologist Albin Zak.
A long time ago.
One of Crosby's representatives heard Jack Mullen's presentations on this new machine, and he thought this was great because Crosby had the most popular radio show in the country. He had had it for 10 years, and then he had decided that he didn't want to be doing this live every week anymore. So he had decided he wanted to record it, and his representative came to Crosby and said, well, you know, I got the thing for you, boss. Is this thing right over here?
Working with the Ampex Corporation in Northern California, the Model 200 tape machine was brought to market in 1948.
They became the company that manufactured this first tape recorder, which Crosby bought a whole lot of for his Crosby Enterprises. But the big artistic move there was when he gave one to Les Paul. And then the story changes at that point.
It's the Les Paul Show.
Les Paul was a guitar legend whose story we told in our previous episode on the electric guitar, and was also a pioneer in studio production.
Yes, we call it the Les Paul Show with Mary Ford.
Along with his wife, Mary Ford, Les had been experimenting with layering sound since the 1940s, effectively creating a one-man band.
Les Paul was fascinated with it because he was doing a practice of overdubbing. He had been doing this with discs. People were doing overdubs for a while. But the problem with that was every time you recorded, you'd record something on one disc, you play it back, play along with it, and record to a second disc. And each time you did that, the surface noise increased, and you can only do it so much before it was not worth listening to anymore.
One of Les Paul's earliest overdubbed hits was a track called Lover, released in 1948, which features him playing 8 different guitar parts. But magnetic tape made much cleaner and clearer recordings, and with a bit of technical wizardry, Les Paul was able to improve his overdubbing technique.
When he got the tape recorder, he realized right away, well, first of all, he's going to have less of a fidelity problem. But he could not record from tape to a second tape because they're expensive machines, and Bing only gave him one. But he was a really gifted sort of tinkerer. And he figured out a way that you could actually add, the tape recorder has 3 heads, so you erase, record, and playback in that order. And he reasoned if you added a 4th head before the erase head, as it played back the sound that you'd already recorded, you could play along with it and record what you were playing now with what you had just played. And then you would have like a sound-on-sound thing. So every time you lay a new sound on, it's going on to the same track as the sound that's already been recorded. So the upshot of that is if you've done 6 overdubs and you mess up the 7th, you have to start all the way over again because these are not on their own separate tracks. They're all going on top of one another.
Music historian and producer Brian Kehew.
Les Paul was quite an innovator. Besides playing the guitar exceptionally, he created techniques layering his sounds on top of each other, which was generally not done. Bye, bye, blues. He created not only the technique, but a very artistic version of it by layering different speeds, different voices, and creating essentially a one-man band where he and his wife would do things together and create a performance that could never have happened in real life.
Oh, bye-bye, blues. Bye-bye,
blues. It really worked out well that he could create and innovate sounds using the studio to detach us from reality was really a stepping board.
Others were experimenting with this technique too, including studio engineer Bill Putnam, another key figure in the advance of studio technology. He recorded the song Confess by the American singer Patti Page, which became the first hit to feature layered vocals by the same singer.
Confess,
confess,
confess, it isn't a crime,
oh no, no crime,
to open your heart to me,
confide in me,
and say that you're mine.
Why don't you tell me you're gonna be mine?
There were articles in the magazines about, you know, what was going on there. How come there's two Patti Pages singing, or three, or four? What is going on? How does that work? And so there were articles in Time magazine and Newsweek magazine explaining to the public what was going on here. But people found it fascinating. You know, it's the equivalent of special effects in the movies, you know? It was like that kind of thing when the first Star Wars movie came out.
The other radical thing about tape was that it could be edited, which meant musicians no longer faced the pressure of having to perform the perfect take. Simon Zagorski-Thomas from the London College of Music.
The recording industry very quickly recognised that you could fix performances that were wrong. So, you know, if I did the first half of the song perfectly but made a mistake in the second verse, but in the previous take I'd done the second verse perfectly, I could just cut the two pieces of tape, stick them together and use the first verse from one and the second verse from another, which is something that's, you know, so common and ubiquitous now. But of course it was a huge, huge thing. And because you could do these repairs, it also meant that you cut down on the amount of time that people had to spend in the studio, because they only have to get it right in two or three takes to make one good one by sticking it all together.
Another byproduct of the war was the reemergence of independent studios across the USA, as soldiers, trained in sound technology, returned home.
In the 1940s, after the Second World War, there was a lot of mostly men who had been trained as radio engineers and signal corps personnel who came out and were demobbed in 1945. And a lot of small studios started up by people who were essentially hobbyists, but who could make a living by selling small-scale recordings to distribution companies. So in the United States, you get a lot of small regional labels start up at this time, things like Chess Records. You've got Sam Phillips in the 1950s starting up Sun Records, which Elvis started on.
Sam Phillips opened the Memphis Recording Service in January 1950. And it would become the home of his label, Sun Records. Phillips had worked as a DJ and radio engineer, and as a record producer, he worked with singers such as Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison, and most famously, Elvis Presley. And utilizing cutting-edge tape techniques, he helped define the sound of rock and roll.
The quintessential rockabilly sound effect is that slapback echo that you hear like an Elvis's voice. It became kind of a stylistic feature of all rockabilly music, and it was an effect from tape. And the whole idea of echo, the repetition of a sound, it runs right through the history of popular music from the time of its invention on up to today.
Greg Milner, author of Perfecting Sound Forever.
The way slapback echo works, which you can hear on things like Elvis Presley's Blue Moon of Kentucky, you use two tape machines, one of which is taking the signal as it's being recorded, and the other is taking the signal with a slight delay, and then they're both being put back onto tape. So the second one is coming in, you know, like a split second later than the first, so it sounds like an echo.
Oh, well, I say Blue Moon of Kentucky, just to keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and let me blue.
If you were in the little room at, you know, Sun Studios while Elvis and his band were doing Blue Moon of Kentucky, if you were the proverbial fly on the wall, you would never hear that echo because it didn't exist in real time. It only existed as something that was added after the fact. So people were starting to realize that, wow, like there's all these creative things that you can do to tape to kind of twist around the experience of recording music. So it's not so much recording music anymore as it is creating music.
And as well as experimenting with tape, producers continued to explore how the ambience of different rooms could affect a recording. Another producer who employed some clever engineering in his studio was Norman Petty, who teamed up with another major star of the rock and roll era, Buddy Holly. All of my love, all of my kissing, you don't know what you've been missing, oh boy. Oh boy. Simon Zagorski-Thomas.
Norman Petty in Clovis, New Mexico, who had a very small studio that was, I mean, the photographs of it looked like a kind of doctor's surgery, you know, it's a small space. He also had an echo chamber in the next building along that he had lines running to and from his studio so that he could send Buddy Holly's vocals to this large echo chamber that was essentially an attic space above his father's garage. So the way that an echo chamber works is that you send a signal from the vocal mic to a completely separate room, and you'd play it back through a speaker in that room, and the sound of that reverberation in that room would then be recorded by another microphone and brought back to your mixing desk, and that would add the sound of the reverberation to the voice without adding it to the rest of the instruments that were playing in the room with the vocalist. One of the interesting things about the Buddy Holly recordings was that on Peggy Sue, Norman Petty sort of thought to himself, "Oh, I could send the drums to the echo chamber." So if you listen carefully to the beginning of Peggy Sue, you get this change between reverberant drums and dry drums, closely mic'd drums, and it sort of is rhythmically mixed backwards and forwards between these two sounds of the drums.
But this wasn't an entirely artistic endeavour. All recording studios, large or small, were part of the music business, and making money was arguably the main driver of musical innovation.
This is always an interaction between music and sound and machines and market. A lot of it comes from the feedback from the marketplace, because there had to be a money-making component or it just wouldn't exist. So after the war, record sales, which had been depressed through the 1930s and the war years, surged. I mean, from 1945 to 1946, Columbia Records sales jumped 850%. So there's just a lot of records being released every single week. And how do you cut through? How do you get anybody to listen to your record when there's, you know, 150 new singles coming out every week?
By the 1950s, an array of new microphones, filters, and effects gizmos were being produced for music studios. And a big part of how artists came up with new and interesting sounds was the use, and more importantly, the abuse, of this new technology.
It can be the most low-tech thing, like Link Wray, the guitarist from the 50s, who used to stab his speaker cone with a stiletto to get his guitar to distort, or Jackie Brenston's Rocket 88, which has that really sweet distorted guitar sound, which resulted from the amp falling off the car roof before the recording session, or the engineers in the 50s who found out strangely that if you took a Pultec equalizer and you both boosted and attenuated the same frequency at the same time, which I don't even know what that means, but if you turn both of those knobs at the same time, it sounded cool. Artists do what they want to do to get the sounds that somehow move them. And then again, when the marketplace accepts them, they take their place in the universe and they become another piece of the rhetorical system that other artists now will likely emulate at some point.
And one very cool sound which started to come to the fore in the 50s was stereo. The illusion where sound can come from different directions. Though stereo had actually been around for a couple of decades before music producers started playing around with it in earnest.
In 1931, Alan Blumlein invents stereo. Well, I say invents stereo. A Frenchman at the beginning of telephony had invented a stereo telephone system where you could listen to two telephones at the same time and they could put the other two in a concert hall so you could listen to a concert in stereo from a long way away. But that happened around 1900 and nobody did anything with it afterwards. In 1931, Alan Blumlein developed the idea of stereo recording, basically for the cinema, because he went to the cinema and watched giant pictures of two people talking on different sides of the screen and the sound was just coming from the one speaker in the centre. And he thought, well, wouldn't it be much more sensible if one voice came from the speaker next to the person on the right and the other voice came from the person on the left?
The 1950s was not just an age of musical experimentation in the recording studio, but in the home too. Sophisticated new stereo hi-fi systems came to market, exciting a new generation of audiophiles. And with it came some curious record releases too. Greg Milner.
Believe it or not, in the 50s, sound effects records, what we would call sound effects records, were huge, and they were really just a way for people to show off their hi-fis and to show off things like stereo separation. So you'd have things like a train going by from left to right. There was actually an album called Rail Dynamics, these stereo recordings of trains that would, you know, sound to people like a train was bearing down on them when they'd hear it. These just crazy, crazy sound recordings, everything from like the buzzing of a fly to lightning striking, you know, a tree. It was almost like stereo was a novelty in and of itself, as opposed to something that could be used, you know, really creatively with music.
And that's largely how stereo was seen for quite some years. While the hi-fi boom was big business, most music fans were still listening to records on a single mono speaker. And with one eye forever on the bottom line, most record companies were of the view that there was no point in spending extra money making stereo records if people weren't going to hear the difference. But another invention, which appeared in 1955, had an immediate impact: multi-track recording. This is the process by which you can isolate the sound of an individual voice or instrument, allowing you to pull apart the ingredients of a song during the recording, rather than the sounds being all stuck together. And the man behind this pioneering invention, once again, Les Paul.
He gave the Ampex Corporation $10,000, which in contemporary money is about $90,000 or something like that. It's a lot of money to develop an 8-channel machine, which was called the Octopus. And that was done in 1958. But it really wasn't the way that other people were working. Les Paul did, and he was willing to pay $10,000 to have a machine that let him do that. But generally, people weren't interested. What they were interested in was a smaller number of tape tracks so that they could record a vocal or two vocals on top of a backing track.
And as the 1950s rolled into the 60s, there was one producer in particular who would really come to make the most of multi-tracking, using it to build layer upon layer of instruments and voices to create what would become known as the Wall of Sound. Phil Spector worked out of Gold Star Studios in LA and would go on to produce some of the most famous female vocal groups of the early 1960s, such as the Crystals and the Ronettes.
Around the end of the 50s, beginning of the 1960s, people like Phil Spector were experimenting with what they could do with sound in the studio. It wasn't so much the tape formats that they used particularly as microphone techniques. In the case of Phil Spector, he would put crazily big bands into very small spaces and then just move microphones around, just move them around in the space until he got what people called his wall of sound.
Music producer and historian Brian Kehew.
One of the things Phil liked to do in the legendary wall of sound he created was to layer multiple players together. You might have four drummers in a room, There might be three bass players playing together when normally there was one of anything. But he realized that the sound of multiple instruments stacked together, it became this huge orchestral sound using popular instruments.
But innovation wasn't unique to the USA. Over in London, a producer by the name of Joe Meek was performing his own experiments in a three-story apartment above a shop, which he had converted into a home studio.
He had his studio in the Holloway Road where he would use different rooms to create these kind of records that didn't sound like anything that had been made before. The idea of recorded sound as interesting noises in music, more than the idea of a great melody and a great arrangement. A sound that is just interesting in its own right, being one of the gimmicks in a record.
Clem Cattini is a drummer who played with the Tornadoes, one of the bands produced by Joe Meek.
You go into his control room, I mean, it was like a death trap. You're surprised he never came out getting electrocuted, to be honest. He made all his own equipment. That's where Joe was the genius. Musically, hadn't got a clue. Didn't know the difference between a crotchet and a hatchet, to be honest with you. He was a genius as far as sounds go. I've been in the toilet many a time, dropping marbles into the toilet, and he recorded the plop as they go in. Stamping up and down, which he recorded. Anything that moved, he recorded.
Joe Meek's most famous hit was Telstar by the Tornadoes, a worldwide number one smash released in 1962.
Even to this day, they try to break down the sounds on Telstar, the rocket sounds. Nobody knows what it is. I mean, there's been several theories. He played things backwards. He probably did, you know. I mean, that's one of his tricks. We record a guitar lick, and then he reversed the tapes, and then recorded it that way onto another machine, you know. Another thing that he did, which he used to turn the tape over, so you got the non-magnetic side going against the heads. So you got a sort of like a jumbled sound, you know, instead of things like this, which he thought of.
The thing about technology is just because it exists doesn't mean that it'll be used creatively. It needs an attitude on the part of the people using it for it to reach its potential. After World War II, there was a public desire for reinvention in all areas of life, which was carried over into music in remarkable ways. In the decades that followed, innovations in the studio were driven by an impulse to distort reality, separating music from the live arena it had occupied for centuries to create something that was brand new.
It's kind of encapsulated in a famous saying from Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, who were very well-known songwriters, very successful songwriters. And what they said, we don't write songs, we write records. And the idea being, of course, they did write the songs. The point being, well, we write the song, but that's kind of like the screenplay. At the end of the day, what we're really going for is the movie. So that means that your aspiration before was to make, however advanced the technology became, you wanted to make it invisible, make it transparent, so the music would come closer and closer to the listener, so it was almost as if they were there in the room with the music. But then when you go to the idea of making a record, now it's more like a film. You're actually trying to do something that is unlike anything in the real world. It's an aesthetic artifact unto itself. And that's a radical, radical change.
Next week, we continue with the story of the studio.
The rules were starting to sort of be broken, and the ones breaking the rules the most were the Beatles.
When you realize that the operative word in making music, the verb is play. We're playing. Let's go in the studio and let's play.
But for now, thanks for listening to A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason. The program was produced by Richard Fenton-Smith and James Beard. The editor is Jasper Corbett. This program was made in association with the Open University.